Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, Syria's Archbishop of Aleppo expresses concern for the future of his country and of Christians there. The Vatican's own train hits the tracks next week. We'll tell you why. And we remember Pope Benedict's 2010 visit to Fatima and John Paul II's special relationship with the Marian Shrine. We go now to Syria, where security forces have been going house to house, arresting people they say have been involved in the revolt sweeping the country. The crackdown has been taking place in the central city of Homs, the coastal city of Banias, some suburbs of the capital Damascus, and villages around the southern city of Dara. On Monday, the European Union imposed an arms embargo on Syria. In a statement, the EU said it is banning the shipment of arms and equipment that could be used for internal repression in Syria. Well, to find out how Christians in Syria have been affected by the pro-democracy uprising and government crackdown, I spoke to the Metropolitan Archbishop of the Greek Melkite Catholic Church of Aleppo, Syria, Monsignor Jean Jambard. He told me that Christians have been watching the events unfolding in the region with alarm.
It is, an insurrection more than a revolution, as they say. Of course, there are many things to be changed in Syria. In Syria, we have to move, to evolve, to liberalize a few things, but not in this way, and not this kind of things.
The Syrian authorities have been blaming outsiders for provoking the demonstrators.
That's right, yes. They blame outsiders, and it is not quite wrong. They may be right in a good part of it. These things are coming from abroad. Of course, using people from the place, from Syria, but many things have been organized and sponsored abroad.
Of course, Syria is made up of a number of minorities. You have President Assad's Alawite community, you have Druze, you have Christians, you have the majority Sunnis.
Shia. The majority is Sunnite. 70% of the people are Sunnite.
Up until now, how have relations been between these various communities, and
very
have
good.
You seen these change?
Till now, we are in good, very good relations. In Aleppo, for example, we are in very good relation. We are friends, we are brothers. In Damascus, the same, in other cities. But, of course, this kind of subversion and violences could change this beautiful atmosphere and beautiful life together, I'm afraid. But we are very good together. We live together. We are friendly. We work together. We celebrate together.
You participated at the Synod of Bishops from the Middle East back in October, where the bishops expressed concern for what they perceive as an increase in Islamic fundamentalism and even violence against Christians in the region, something that we've been seeing in Egypt recently. How concerned are you that this might spill over also into Syria?
This is our fear. We are afraid about that. Till now in Syria there were no difficulties. The fundamentalism was something marginalized. But now with what is happening, we are afraid that it may blow up. And I hope that it will not, because it will be disastrous for everybody. And it will not be settled as easily as they think, because the geopolitical situation of the country is very peculiar, very special. And there is, of course, the party who is strong, the army, our people are, faithful to the president.
Assad has indicated he's willing to allow Islamists to exert more control over society there in Syria, as long as they don't interfere in politics. He's also moved to placate conservative Sunnis by promising to open an Islamic university, ease bans on wearing the full veil. Are Christians concerned that Syria is becoming more of an Islamic state?
I don't think so, because if he leaves everybody, every community be free in the way it lives, it may work. It's better to give them this possibility than to let them always under pressure. Like that, they will openly do and say what they want, provided that they do not be violent and that do not use arms and not use the religion for political or for domination objective. Anyway, this is, of course, something which is a problem for us for the future if it continues. But I'm afraid that if he gives a margin of liberty, of freedom, it's good and it will allow the others, everybody, to say what he has to say, to be free to express himself, and to confront with the others in a few points. And I am not sure that all the Muslims in that case will stand by the fundamentalists or the conservatives of Muslims. Many are more secular, and there are the other communities who prefer that secularity may be more respected in the country in order to be able to live freely and to have their rights as much as the others. As you said when you began, there are at least seven denominations, in large denominations in the country: Muslim, Sunnite, Shia, Alawite, Christian, Ismaili, etc. And Kurd, even though they have Muslim religion, but they have also their specificities, their identity. And all these people used to live together, and we live together. We work together, and I think that the majority, the large majority of all of them, do not want what is happening. We want, everybody wants renewal, everybody wants progress and evolution, everybody wants more freedom, but no one wants civilian war or this kind of violence.
Are people frustrated there that, you know, they see NATO intervening to stop the bloodshed in Libya? Are they saying, why isn't anybody paying attention to what's happening in Syria? Why doesn't anyone intervene here?
It's not the same situation. It is not the same situation in Libya. There are people who are, all a region who is against Gaddafi. And Gaddafi has nothing to do with Bashar Assad. The government in Libya has nothing to do with the government in Syria. The structure and the organization and the participation of the people. It doesn't mean that the Baath Party has many virtues, but he has also a few qualities, and he has put together people of different denomination, different religions, and he tried to help the poorer of the society. With the time, of course, he has become a little like a little company, but now they are reforming, and I think that this has to be reformed. No, you cannot compare it, and you cannot think the same way in Syria and in Libya. It's quite different. And it is in Syria, finally, it is the same people, even though there are several religions, but it is the same people and the same language. I would like to ask Christians in every country and everywhere to pray for us and to ask the Lord to help us to overcome this problem, to allow us to remain friendly in this country, to remain brothers, to live together, to be an example of conviviality, of being together, of different religion and denominations. And this is necessary nowadays in the world, particularly in the Middle East. I ask everybody outside, bishops, people, religious, politicians, influent people, I ask them to try whatever possible not to allow that Christians may leave this country, may go away. We'll do whatever possible ourselves to stay here. We have been for 2,000 years in this country. It is our country. We are bearers of the face of Jesus Christ. We are testimony of the resurrection of the church, which was born in Syria, and we are in duty to remain here and to continue the presence of Christians and the church in this country. We don't want to go away. We ask our people not to go away, and we ask our friends everywhere, not to encourage our Christians to go away, and not to encourage people to push the Christians to go away. The Christians are very important here. They are the salt of this country, and we are signs of the presence of God and Christ everywhere. And we want to be missionary in this country. We want to be testimony in this country. And we hope that the Lord and our friends will help us to realize this mission and to stay where we are.
And our prayers certainly go out to the people of Syria and to the Metropolitan Archbishop of Aleppo, Monsignor Jean Chambar.
It's the shortest national railway system in the world, with just one tiny station, no registered rolling stock, and no railway workers. It's rarely used, but on Saturday the 21st of May 2011, the Vatican City-State railway station will open its two sets of tracks of only 300 metres long, especially to mark the 60th anniversary of Caritas Internationalis and to raise funds for its worldwide humanitarian work. We spoke to Monsignor Bob Vitillo, head of the Caritas delegation to Geneva and one of the organisers, about the initiative.
Yes, the event we're calling the Caritas Express, and we will be having a train leaving Vatican City Rail Station, which is a fully equipped rail station but very rarely used, and it will go to Orvieto. And the train will be composed of historic trains, mostly of 1930s vintage. And we're doing this in very close cooperation with the Governatorato of Vatican City State and with the Ferrovia dello Stato, the Italian state railway system.
Who and why came up with this initiative?
Actually, the train was first proposed by the Australian ambassador to the Holy See, His Excellency Tim Fisher. Tim, in a previous life, was the head of a private railway system in Australia, and he's a real expert on trains, especially historic trains. And so he thought that this would be a very special way to mark the anniversary of Caritas Internationalis. We're moving the very day after the train ride into the 19th General Assembly of Caritas. And so we'll be very, very busy with doing the work of the Confederation. And he thought this was a joyous way to mark our anniversary.
Looking back on 60 years of Caritas Internationalis, what have been the major achievements as someone who's worked for a very long time with the organization, and what would you see as the main challenges that lie ahead?
I feel like I was with it for 60 years, but actually I started working here at the General Secretariat of Caritas in 1986, so 25 years ago my association with the Confederation started. And in looking back over the history that I've heard and then also that I lived part of, certainly Caritas is distinguished for its work in doing charity, but also in coordinating the work of charity so that we could have more energy, more force of the gospel as we respond to the needs of poor and marginalized people throughout the world. A great deal of the work of Caritas Internationalis as a confederation is to work on helping to coordinate response and humanitarian assistance in disasters. Also, we're very involved in advocating for the poor and marginalized, and together with them, at the highest levels of society, at the United Nations and intergovernmental and international organizations, so that we could bring the voice of the poor to those who are policymakers and decision makers. And then also, as a confederation, we are very involved in helping to build capacity with our national member organizations so that we could do the work of charity in a very professional way, but also in a way that's motivated by our faith.
Would you say this perhaps is one of the biggest challenge for the future? It's reconciling the two. I mean, Benedict XVI, in his very first encyclical, spoke about how the Christian perceived the meaning of charity. He also has frequently spoken about reconciling the spiritual aspect or the spiritual nature of charity and the practical application of charity on the ground. Do you see this as a big challenge for the future and for Caritas?
Well, I'll speak first from my personal experience. I guess I learned best how to do that in my own work with Caritas by listening to the poor, because I think they're able to recognize spirituality and the life of poverty and coming out of a life of poverty very, very well. They know that they depend on God for everything, and yet then they also know that they have to bring all of their skills just to be able to survive and then to better their lives for themselves and for their families. So I think we learn from them how to reconcile these things and know that there's no difference between being professional and being people of the gospel.
And then, of course, looking ahead to the 19th General Assembly, which, as you said, begins the very day after this historic train ride, shall we call it, from Vatican City State. What is the major theme for this General Assembly, which will draw hundreds of delegates from around the world, from very different realities, cultures, and backgrounds? What is the main theme?
The theme of this General Assembly is One Human Family, Zero Poverty. And as that theme was chosen by the executive committee of Caritas Internationalis, they really reflected deeply, because they know it's a very bold theme to talk about zero poverty. But once again, we believe that if we are really going to implement the gospel as Jesus asked us to, that we have to believe that there can be zero poverty, and we can do that by building one human family.
In May 2010, Pope Benedict XVI was in Fatima, Portugal, for a four-day pastoral visit, which took him to Lisbon and to the Marian Shrine of Fatima. Veronica Scarisbrick was with the Pope on that trip and looks back at some of the Holy Father's remarks to the people of one of Europe's most Catholic but poorest nations.
Venio come pellegrino di Nostra Signora di Fatima.
I come, he remarked, as a pilgrim to Our Lady of Fatima, referring to the apparitions which took place in the Marian Shrine almost a century ago, describing this moment as a window of hope that God opens when a man closes the door to him. Let's recall for a moment how this apostolic visit has two levels of interest. First of all, of Marian devotion, in continuity with the successors of Peter, Paul VI first, and then John Paul II, who all travelled to Fatima on the date of the apparitions, on the 13th of May, the date when Our Lady appeared to three little shepherd children for the first time. Curiously, in Fatima, they're referring to this continuity with the papacy, dubbing him Utercero Papa, the third pope. The third pope, then, who in turn referred to the words of a well-known cardinal from the Salazar era, who once remarked, it was not the Church that imposed Fatima, but it was Fatima that imposed itself on the Church. But it was the second level of interest, the more official one, the Holy Father highlighted, picking up on that special historical connection between Portugal and the successor of Peter, noting how the people of this nation have since the earliest days of their nationhood looked to the successor of Peter for recognition of their existence as a people. Benedict XVI then placed the Church in a historical context once again, pointing out its openness to cooperating with anyone who does not marginalize or reduce to the private sphere the essential consideration of the human meaning of life. The point at issue, he insisted, is not an ethical confrontation between a secular and a religious system, so much as a question about the meaning that we give to freedom. The Pope then went back to the landmark date of the Proclamation of the Republic, highlighting how by separating Church and State, the Republican Revolution, which took place 100 years ago in Portugal, opened a new area of freedom for the Church, to which two concordats of 1940 and 2004 would give shape in cultural settings and ecclesial perspectives, profoundly marked by rapid change. I'm Veronica Scarisbrick.
Ahead of the trip, Veronica spoke with Portugal's ambassador to the Holy See, João Alberto Bacelar da Rocha Paris,
The signing of a new concordat between the Holy See and Portugal back in 2004 confirmed the historical relations between the Catholic Church and Portugal, highlighting the mutual responsibility in building a society that promotes the dignity of the human person, justice and peace. How easy is this in Portugal's increasingly secular society like everywhere else in Europe?
Yes, I really do not think that the defense of human dignity, justice and freedom be incompatible with today's increasingly wide trend towards secular societies. I think that in this respect, I'd like to recall a quite important speech delivered some years ago by President Nicolas Sarkozy here in Rome in the Basilica of St. John in Lateran, in which he spoke about the principle of positive light, later elaborated in several occasions by Pope Benedict XVI, which is not more than the admission of the fact that the roles of the Church and of the state may be complementary and may complement each other in our societies to the benefit of humankind. As a matter of fact, I think that we are here confronted to nothing more than recalling the very old say that according to which to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God. So I think that there is a perfect compatibility between the two sectors of our life today.
During his 2010 visit to Portugal, Pope Benedict celebrated a special mass for tens of thousands of pilgrims in Fatima to honor the 10th anniversary of the beatification of Francisco and Jacinta, two of the three children to whom Our Lady appeared in the small Portuguese village almost a century before. The two shepherd children died when they were still very young. But Sister Lucia dos Santos, the last of the three to survive, lived in her convent in Coimbra, Portugal, until her death in 2005 at the ripe old age of 98. Pope John Paul II had a special relationship with Sister Lucy, as she is also known. Theirs was a friendship that spanned decades, until the Pope's own death in 2005, less than 2 months after the death of Sister Lucy. The two had kept in touch regularly, up to the very last moments of their lives, and, as you'll soon hear, with special reason. She was a quiet, introspective child whose encounter with a radiant lady in white changed her life forever. Lucia and her two cousins, Francisco and Jacinta, saw Our Lady a total of 6 times in their village of Fatima. It was 1917, the height of the First World War, and a period of religious persecution in Portugal. The shepherd children told of 3 prophecies that Our Lady had revealed to them. The first, a vision of hell, where those who fail to repent their sins will fall. The second predicted the outbreak of World War II. The third prophecy, not revealed until the year 2000, predicted an attempt on the life of a pope, a bishop dressed in white. That pope was Pope John Paul II, who survived an assassin's bullet in St. Peter's Square on May 13, 1981. He attributed his recovery to the Virgin Mary, whose feast was celebrated that very day. The bullet is today lodged in the crown of the Virgin statue in Fatima. Pope John Paul met Sor Lucia 3 times, the last of which was in May 2000 for celebrations in Fatima marking the beatification of Francisco and Jacinta. It was the last time Sister Lucia appeared in public. In a radio appeal, she called on Portugal to remain faithful to God and to thank God for the graces he has given the world through the Madonna.
Que procurem ser fiéis a Deus e agradecidos às graças que Deus, por meio de Nossa Senhora, tem concedido a Portugal e ao mundo.
Though the prophecies she and the other children bore were troubling, how did Sister Lucia perceive them?
The National Director of the Pontifical Mission in Austria, Father Leo Massberg, met Sister Lucy several times and gives us some insight.
I'm sure that she was a person of deep suffering. All the big saints are people of deep suffering. But she didn't suffer in the way which we might normally imagine. I believe that she suffered because the message of love which God gave through her and through Our Lady was not accepted. So in this sense, she is a bearer of a sad message. But the sadness is that we did not accept the message. It's not that the message is sad. The message is a message of hope, because God entrusted her with a wonderful promise. He said that you will remain in this world for quite some time, quite many years actually. And Jesus wants this because he wants to use you so that people may recognize me, Our Lady, and love me. And he, Jesus, wants to introduce the devotion to my Immaculate Heart. And those who accept this devotion, I promise salvation, and many souls will love God, and they are like the flowers which are put in front of me to ornament his throne. So what she really does, or what Our Lady does in that message, she describes a type of soul. And if you look at the people who accept that message, it's very interesting. They are like a big family. The family of those who have the tenderness of heart. And this tenderness of heart, Lucia herself had in a very, very high degree. You immediately felt at home with her. So she was a bearer of this message, and she was obviously living that message herself very, very strongly.
It's a very interesting woman. It's a complete woman. Of course, a very religious woman. But even on a natural aspect, it's a very humoristic Sister Lucia. Always happy, always glad.
Monsignor Luciano Guerra was the rector of the Shrine of Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal. He told me he was convinced Sister Lucia offered her sacrifices for the Pope.
Because the Pope has a very special place in the devotion of the children of Fatima. So, because Our Lady spoke about the Pope, the mission of the Pope in the world, and the children, especially little Jacinta, had a very, very intense and special devotion to the Holy Father. So every time she had a sacrifice or a prayer to offer, they did remember the Holy Father as the fourth intention they had. First intention was to consider the conversion of sinners. Second intention was peace. Another intention was in reparation for the sinners against the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And then the fourth intention was exactly the Holy Father. And little Jacinta did never forget this intention. And she had also two visions about the Holy Father consecrating the world to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. So it's very, very intense, this link between the message of Fatima, between the lives of the children, and the Holy Father, the Pope.
Monsignor Luciano Guerra, the former rector of the Shrine of Our Lady of Fatima. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.